Hey, Blenders, on this week's show, we have seen Joker 2 and the new thriller Speak No Evil hits theater, so we have James McAvoy and director James Watkins.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
You need parts? O'Reilly Auto Parts has parts. Need them fast? We've got fast. No matter what you need, we have thousands of professional parts people doing their part to make sure you have it. Product availability. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Fall's here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome. Welcome to episode number 321 of Real Blend, a podcast that bids farewell to the great James Earl Jones, legendary actor and the voice of this generation. My name is Sean O'Connell. I'm the managing editor at Cinema Blend. On this week's show, we have seen Joker 2. The new thriller Speak No Evil is hitting theaters, and because of that, star James McAvoy is going to join us for an exclusive interview alongside his director, James Watkins. A lot of show to get to. Let me jump right into it. Introduce the boys. We got Jake Hamilton. We got Kevin McCarthy. We got Gabe Kovach in the producer's chair. How's everyone doing today?
Good, man. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing,
fantastic,
man?
Fantastic.
Doing okay. Doing okay. Yeah, a lot to get to. Starting with a solemn note, James Earl Jones. Listening to a lot of, clips and people were just remembering his iconic roles. Jakey, what kind of jumps to mind immediately when you think about James Earl Jones and his contributions to the cinematic universe?
I mean, he is one of those actors who, if you put 10 people in a room and said, name me your favorite James Earl Jones performance, it's entirely likely you'll get 10 different answers. There are, of course, always the go-tos. There's obviously he was, the voice of Darth Vader, for which he didn't even want credit for those first two movies, because he wanted all the attention to be on David Prowse, the actor who was in the costumes. Obviously, Mufasa, Hunt for Red October was a Stone Cold masterpiece. If you've never seen... you're going to laugh at me, but if you've never seen his Big Bang Theory episode where he plays himself,
I saw the clip.
It's hilarious. But my mind goes to being in Dyersville, Iowa a few years back for the Field of Dreams game, where they recreated, the field for the very first professional Major League Baseball game that was going to be played out there in the corn. And being in that crowd of only a couple of hundred people, it was very small and intimate. And feeling the wave of emotions when all of a sudden the lights dimmed and they started playing that Field of Dreams score. But the way I watched grown men break when over the speakers you just heard James Earl Jones say, the people will come, Ray. And they played out his monologue over the just the sun setting over the corn and just the soft music. And it was right before Kevin Costner walked out of the corn himself. But the power of that monologue, the way I watched genuinely a crowd of men break and shed a tear, of which I did myself, it's just a testament to not just his talents, but what he meant to people and what his roles in his films and really his humility meant to people.
Kev, I'm going to jump to the conclusion that Sandlot's got to be up there for you.
That's the first thing that comes to mind. Actually,
great call.
Before Star Wars.
Yeah.
Like the first thing that comes to mind for James Earl Jones for me is Sandlot.
Yeah, I figured as much.
That's the first time I ever saw James Earl Jones.
Yeah.
Because Sandlot was what, 93, I think?
Yeah.
So I was nine.
It would have been before Mufasa.
I was nine, and I hadn't seen the original trilogy until maybe I was like 11 or 12 of Star Wars. And also, like you said, with Vader, it's being played by a different actor physically. So the voice, obviously was, it was James Earl Jones, but at the end of the day, my first visual and voice performance of James Earl Jones was The Sandlot. And I always thought that the ending of that film is so brilliant because, with Smalls and, like, you know, everything going on with, you know, with the Beast and the PF Flyers and, you know, the ball being, you know, destroyed. And then James Earl Jones happened to be a baseball player as well, had this incredible ball signed by the legends of baseball that he gives to Smalls to give to his stepfather. Was it Dennis Leary who plays the stepfather?
Yeah. Didn't he say, like when there was like, oh, like the ball was signed by Babe Ruth, and he's like, George signed this?
Yeah.
Like, it's just the most casual line delivery. It was fantastic.
Yeah. The way he said, I always loved that because it was like, it humanized Babe 100%. Ruth in a way that was like, oh, like, this guy is just named George.
Yeah.
Cause his character was like he was like a rival team, right?
I just remember he got hit in the head with a ball, right? And that's what blinded him.
And went blind. Yeah. And so I don't know. I always, when I was a kid, because the entire film is leading up to that moment of like them being scared, the characters being scared that their ball has gone over this fence, and this incredibly like scary dog, it ends up just licking Smalls's face anyways. And then you have just as nice of a person who's living in that house who wants to help the kids. And James Earl Jones just plays that character with such a comfort. It feels like a baseball glove, like fitting into a baseball glove. Like that's genuinely what that character felt like to me, like a warm blanket.
Sean, I have a question. I genuinely don't, I'm not asking this question in like a sarcastic mocking way, but because you're a few years older than us, Kevin, and I, to your point, Kevin, whenever I watched that movie, and the reveal was that the man across the fence was James Earl Jones.
Right,
other than me just really liking the guy, I wasn't like, oh my God, that's James Earl Jones. Oh my God, it's the voice of Darth Vader. You know, like, it didn't really have, until I got older. I was like, oh my God, that's cool. That was James Earl Jones. Yeah. Sean, with you being a little bit older and I'm assuming obviously having a knowledge of who James Earl Jones was at that point, did it play as like a big celebrity reveal? Like, how did it play whenever you watched it?
Yeah, the weird thing is I didn't see Sandlot until much, much later.
Oh, interesting.
Because in 93, I was in... Oh my God. Like, I was a freshman in college.
Okay.
So I didn't go see Sandlot. Like, that was like,
I was five.
Movie. Yeah. It was a kid movie to me. So I probably didn't see it until, you know, much, much later. And by that point, I think I probably even knew that James Earl Jones was kind of in it.
Sort
of thing. So it didn't have that kind of impact. But
I'm curious,
find
in the comment section, like for anyone who's old enough to have seen it with a knowledge of James, I'm curious as to how it was meant to be played. I'm curious as if it was meant to be played as a celebrity cameo.
Jake, do you
I'm
think sure. that's the first time you ever saw James Earl Jones?
No, I mean, physically saw him?
Yeah.
For me, I think it might have been,
I do remember as a kid loving Coming to America, but I'm assuming I probably saw that later.
That, like, his two most iconic roles, which I'm going to argue is Mufasa and Darth Vader, that he's not visible for them.
Sure.
Yeah.
You know? There has to be someone I'm not thinking of, but I'm trying to think of somebody whose most famous roles are voice roles, who is still a prominent actor who's been in a number of incredible things. Like, you could point to like Tom Hanks and Woody, or
Robin Williams and Genie.
Yeah, I guess. But like, James Earl Jones has Darth Vader Mufasa.
I streamed the debate last night through HBO Max, which was inherently a CNN streaming, and during the commercial break, they played the "This is CNN." Oh, wow. And I was like, "Oh,
that's cool. That's really cool."
Did James Earl Jones never go to a Star Wars set?
Okay, to that point, that episode of Big Bang Theory that I'm talking about, where he plays himself, Carrie Fisher also played herself in that episode, and that was the very first time they ever met.
Wow. So James Earl Jones. So hold on, let me walk me through the history real quick. So they film the 77 Star Wars, and James Earl Jones. So was he? Oh, like, how did the voice come about? Like, was someone else voicing it initially?
Well, there's video of David Prowse reading the lines on the set. But I think the plan was pretty quickly to, and maybe it wasn't immediately, but I think they figured out pretty quickly David Prowse's voice was just not going to work.
Yeah. Right.
But I just don't think there was any particular reason for James Earl Jones to go to the set.
Right. Sure, he just did like ADR after the fact.
Yeah, because keep in mind they shot in London, so,
and they were already like, by the time they shot Empire, they were already being secretive on set too. So I imagine, you know, I don't know how
I just
practiced they were, but I imagine, you know, you're not bringing people that don't need to be there.
And also, one of the most misconstrued lines in film history is "Luke, I am your father," because he doesn't say
no,
"Luke, I am your father."
I am your father.
Well, why does every T-shirt says "Luke, I am your father"? Everyone thinks it's that line.
It's just one of those, mental.
Like, one of those things.
I mean, it's, you know, we're going to need a bigger boat versus you're going to need a bigger boat.
Right.
Yeah, interesting.
Right. So hold on. So James Earl Jones recorded "No, I am your father" in an ADR booth.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is, I mean, think and about then, that for
Kevin,
one
really,
second.
I really want you to, you can watch this episode without, if you get the chance, in Big Bang Theory, Sheldon is trying to put together his own Comic-Con because he wasn't able to get Comic-Con tickets. So he, through Twitter, stalks where James Earl Jones is at a sushi restaurant and tracks him down, and James Earl Jones is there. And there's this great moment where he goes, "Let me guess, you like Star Wars." And he kind of nods his head and he goes, "Come here." He goes, "I got one thing to say to people like you." And there's a great beat. And he goes, "I like Star Wars too." And he ends up being like the nicest. The whole episode, it's like James Earl Jones dragging Sheldon around to different things in L.A. And Sheldon finally getting to the point where it's like, "I got to go. I got to get out of here."
But that's the whole point of James Earl Jones, is like, naturally, he was so intimidating.
Yes.
Right.
In whatever role he showed up in, whether it was the father from Coming to America.
Oh, God, Coming to America.
The voice
of
Mufasa. Like, he just had that presence. But then when you got past that, he was this. See, for me, I was watching clips of him doing Fences. He was the original.
Oh, God. Yeah. He was Troy from Fences.
Yeah. And I mean, the clips that I got to see yesterday of him doing it.
Did you watch? I'm curious if you watched the same one I did about the "Who Says I Got to Like You."
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh,
that's the one I was watching.
Well, that's what Denzel came out and gave a great statement about, because they both played the same part.
Right, right, right. God, can you imagine?
I know we got to move on, but we have to at least mention Conan the Barbarian.
Oh God, yes. Oh, yeah. Good pull.
That might be one of the first times I saw him too, because Arnold was my favorite actor as a kid. And I was going through his filmography after T2, and I was like going back to the earlier stuff. And Conan, again, next to The Sandlot, that's probably those first couple films I ever saw James Earl Jones in. And then obviously with Lion King, I didn't see him. You hear him. But he had, last thing I'll say is this, his voice was so powerful that it transcended the physical form of having him on screen as an actor. He literally, does that make sense? Like, he literally could make you feel like you were seeing him, because it was such a, I don't know, he had such a life in the performance.
And don't forget, he had a stutter as a kid.
Mm-hmm. Did he? Mm-hmm.
You mentioned seeing him for the first time, and I remember as a kid, Sandlot was a revelation.
Huge.
Vader was Vader. And mm-hmm. Mufasa was Mufasa. I don't even think at the time I connected the two. Like, I was that young. And seeing Sandlot, someone must have told me, like a parent or something, seeing that reveal in the movie and going like, huge, that's Darth Vader, and hearing it and going, that's Darth Vader, and just being like, wait, someone else can be the guy?
Right.
And like, just not even understanding.
It's
like,
crazy.
Just blew my mind.
A really fun story you guys will appreciate. He did an interview on the Dick Cavett Show years and years and years. It was long enough to be on the Dick Cavett Show. And Dick Cavett asked him, did you ever play a prank with the Darth Vader voice? And he said, one time. Because it is his voice, but he also puts on, like, there is a performance to it.
It's a performative voice. Yeah.
And he said, for some reason, he was like riding with someone in like a truck or something, and got like the CB radio and started like saying things as Darth Vader. Like, whenever like they had to respond, that he would respond as Darth Vader.
Yeah.
And he said they pulled into a truck stop, and there was like a gathering of truck drivers all like gathered together talking about, like, did you guys hear Darth Vader on the radio? Like, them trying to like figure out like which, because they knew it had to be someone around them, because it had to be within distance of the CB radio.
Yeah.
And all of them being like kind of freaking out, because they knew somewhere around was the voice of Darth Vader.
That's awesome. Very cool. All right. So we want to hear from you guys. What is the scene or moment that first comes to your guys' mind? Let us know in the comments down below when you think of the great James Earl Jones. We're going to move on. We got a ton of show to get to. If you're watching us on YouTube below, thank you very much. Hit subscribe. Turn on your notifications. Join us here every time we drop a new episode. But more specifically, continue to share the show with friends. We really appreciate you guys checking us out. I'm reading the comments down below underneath the different episodes and checking out the elements you guys are really enjoying. We're going to recommend a couple of films for you guys a little bit later in the show, and it'll tie back to some of the guests that we've been having. If you'd like to sign up for Real Blend Premium, we appreciate that. It gets you an ad-free version of the show and a newsletter from me every other Friday. So check the description for information on where you can sign up. for Real Blend Premium. Okay, as promised, before we went down the James Earl Jones rabbit hole, we have an interview this week on behalf of the new film Speak No Evil, which is here in theaters. We're thrilled to be joined by the great James McAvoy, one of our favorite actors, a really great interview that we've had multiple times, but have never had him on Real Blend. So really great to be able to have him on here, talk about his parts, different roles that he's had over the course of his career, working with M. Night Shyamalan, the way that it fed into the work he does with James Watkins here on Speak No Evil. So here's James McAvoy and James Watkins talking about their brand new film, which is coming to theaters today.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, like Aloe or Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret? With Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whatever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/try to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/try.
So I'm going to start out with this urban legend that I've always heard, which is that Stanley Kubrick never really told the young actor who played Danny in The Shining just what kind of movie they were making. I think he told him it was more of a thriller, but very much that it was not the horror movie we all know and love. When you guys are dealing with young actors in this genre, how much do you tell them? Is it a different time now? Or are kids used to this? And I gotta be honest, there's a lot of things you just can't hide from these kids in this movie.
Totally. I mean, that's over to you, really.
Yeah. I mean, we told them everything. Yeah. You know, we'd had chats with their parents, the chaperones, there's people from sort of, you know, from, you know, because we shoot in the UK, there's welfare and government, you know, social service type stuff. And yeah, I mean, you say it gently and you talk it through and you have to have be clear on what the boundaries are and stuff like that. But yeah, I think they'd read the script. And to be honest, sometimes the thing, James can speak to this, when you work with child actors, sometimes they're so scarily professional that you're like, whoa, you know.
Yeah, no, totally. They both were. They were incredible. Right. But I think as well, we had to do duty of care. We had to definitely check in with the chaperone, the parents, with the kids themselves. But at the same time, you kind of got to read the kid and go, they seem okay. They seem like completely in charge of the situation in their own terms. But if we're sitting there going like informing them that actually you should be worried, this is a heavy thing, whatever, you're going to give them that energy that they didn't come in with. Then make them feel like, God, should I be traumatized? Should I not be okay with this? You know?
That's right. I didn't think about that. That's awesome.
We tell this story on this podcast a number of times. I'm sure our listeners have heard it. But during the filming of Dr. Sleep with Mike Flanagan, there's a harrowing scene with Rebecca Ferguson where she's torturing a child actor. And it was his birthday. He just sort of popped in. He was like ready to go. And she was like wiping tears so as not to ruin his take. And it didn't affect him at all. So I think they're prepared for a lot more than we give them credit for.
Yeah, I agree.
One of the moments when I really started to judge Patty's character throughout the course of this film, and it's obviously a seesaw, we're back and forth a lot on him, was the moment that he allowed his son to sit and watch Chuck Norris's Missing in Action. I just found that to be a very unusual choice, very amusing. And I just want to know why Joe Zito's movie was the one that Ant was watching. Is there any sort of backstory behind that choice?
There's actually quite a big backstory, because when the script, it's Tom and Jerry, and you know, Paddy has this line, "That's my boy." And in Tom and Jerry, there's two characters, but kind of bulldogs called Spike and his son Tyke. And Spike always goes, "That's my boy," you know. And so it's that. And again, Tom and Jerry, you know, is very encoded with violence. I mean, it's an incredibly violent cartoon.
Sure.
And I can't remember. I think it's Disney, right? And we couldn't get the rights, right? I think, and obviously,
what happened?
There's all sorts of associations. There's, you know, racist associations. There's difficult things going back with that cartoon. So we couldn't get it. So we had to go, okay, Paddy, you know, if you look at his music, he likes a lot of kind of 80s stuff. Yeah. So we thought he had this, and it's like, and then we sort of thought, you know, also there's a little bit of, I mean, there's a little bit of Chuck Norris in Paddy's look, right, you know, with the beard and all of that and the masculinity.
Slight bullet, yeah.
So we kind of thought, yeah, you know, that kind of his whole, it was kind of a little in joke when we were in the edit. We thought, hey, you know what, why don't we go with that? And the idea that he doesn't care that this, that his son is watching these uber violent things. I don't know.
I just love as well that they're like, they've got this house in the country, they're back to basics, they're like rustic, they're living off the land, they're foraging for food and all that kind of stuff. And but you think, like, they must have cable, they must have a satellite dish, they must have like they must be able to watch Amazon or have Wi-Fi or something like that. No, they don't. They watch tapes,
VHS tapes.
on a tiny TV. I love that.
That is amazing. You know, whenever I speak with actors and filmmakers involved in a remake, I feel like oftentimes the boring go-to junket question is always, oh, did you watch the original? Did you like the original? But I don't like asking that question because more often than not, I'm always told no, or I didn't rewatch it, or I didn't want to watch it until after we filmed this one. So I'd love to know, as a storyteller and an actor, what is the worst thing that can come out of keeping a close relationship with the original film? Like, what's the negative that can come out of watching it right before you go on set?
I think that every choice I make, then I would have an opposite choice in my head, or even a similar choice in my head. So if I'm trying to make an organic choice that, like, all right, I want to do this with the character, I'm thinking about a similar choice that someone else made, and then do I want to change that choice then? Or I don't want to have to compare myself to another actor or another narrative as well, where the narrative was slightly different. Sometimes it's the same when you read the book before you make the movie. You'll go like, but they did this in the book. And I've been with so many writers and directors, we're like, yeah, but this is what happened in the book. And the writer and directors are going like, I don't give a fuck. It's like, this is what we're doing in the fucking movie.
Did
okay?
you experience that with It? Was it a similar sort of thing?
I feel like It was actually pretty faithful to the book.
Mm-hmm.
Andy was really lovingly transported the book, I think, at most points. I remember The Turtle. Do you know the book?
I do.
I love the book. It's one of my favorites.
It's a masterpiece.
The Turtle is such a sort of thing that keeps coming to them, and they keep like just talking about the turtle and like the turtle can't save us and all that. And I kept trying to put the turtle into the movie like at every opportunity. And Andy was like so kind and so nice. He never shot me down. But whenever I put the turtle in, I think he was just thinking, I'm going to be cutting that out of the movie.
That's awesome.
Mr. McAvoy, can you also speak to having Aisling as a scene partner? I just feel like your performance almost can't work unless her crazy sort of matches your crazy.
Aisling is an incredible actor. I remember when you said that you'd cast her, one of the things that you said was she's going to ground you so much. She's going to ground the movie so much because she's just not got an untrue bone in her body. She's actually got one of my favorite lines in the entire film. They got a pretty good laugh when I watched it with an audience. Is when Ant is throwing the American football and she's just sitting there like looking so sad and she goes, God, he's rubbish. And just, like, it really made me laugh. She's brilliant. She's really brilliant. And we really bonded and connected almost immediately in the first day of rehearsals over the kind of relationship that Paddy and Kira had, and over the as much as they're lying a lot and they're portraying themselves as one thing, but really they're another. The thing that is true about them is that, and whether she's been groomed into this relationship or not, they genuinely have a passionate and heartfelt love for one another as well. Sure. As well as it being violent and abusive and all that, the love is, in a messed up way, totally real. So you've got this like good guy couple who've got the kind of relationship you never want to have, and which sadly I recognize all too much. And then you have this bad guy couple who have the kind of love that you can only dream of having and you kind of fantasize about having one day in your life. And I love that juxtaposition of those two couples having dinner together, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Mr. McAvoy, I am of the belief, genuinely, and I've told you this before, that you deserved an Oscar nomination for Split. I think it's one of the best performances this century. And I remember when that movie came out, telling people that and people going, OK, sure, but movies like that don't get nominated for Oscars. Yeah. And I always said, like, OK, well, why not? That's ridiculous. And obviously there are exceptions to horror movies being nominated by the Academy. But more often than not, they're not. I'd love to get your thoughts on the genre and its relationship to the Oscars. And was there ever a talk of the studio pushing for an Oscar campaign for your Split performance?
I don't know. I might be doing Universal a disservice there. I didn't feel like too strong. And also the timing of our film coming out wasn't.
It came out in January, I think, right? I think it would have been like a year. Yeah.
Get Out changed things a bit.
Get Out changed things a little bit. Yeah. I think Split came out after Get Out, so didn't change things that much for me. God damn it. I think the genre, I mean, maybe there's the legacy and the history of the genre, maybe it was seen as more schlocky or something like that, whereas latterly I feel like it's becoming more socially fueled as well. And look, getting to work with Blumhouse, what, third time now, it's a privilege because they do this thing where they make something that is entertaining, it is populist, it is funny, it is scary, and yet it is underpinned with some real DNA of social commentary as well. And mm-hmm. for them to do that with such consistency and such success, it's an amazing achievement. But maybe there's some feeling of like 2+2=scare, just like in comedy, 2+2=laugh. Mm-hmm. Maybe that just seems formulaic or something like that to the powers that be, but the voters that be. Maybe that's why it is still, but I think horror is one of the most interesting and creative genres at the moment. So it still doesn't make sense to me massively why it's consistently overlooked.
Yeah, and the cool thing about the horror genre is, I mean, to your point, talking about the difference in relationships, horror is oftentimes used as a vessel to say something else. Like it's never just like boo scare. It is always sort of like a really cool statement. All of Stephen King's works always said something about So
absolutely,
I agree with you.
Absolutely.
Mr. Watkins, I want you to talk about costume design, specifically the clothes that Patty wears. It was kind of funny to have you mention the Chuck Norris bit. I wanted you to talk about the sunglasses that you found for him specifically. For some reason, I feel like the sunglasses that he wears say a lot about him and his personality. So like an aggressiveness to it. Can you talk about the choice of those?
I think, the choice was with Keith Madden and James and I, we sat down and just tried things on and see what a lot of it is. My process is, and particularly when it's, James has to wear the clothes, right? So whatever ideas we have, we talk about it, and we talk about the sort of outdoorsy nature and the shorts and the boots and the, the plaid tops and whatever it is, and contrasting him with Ben, who's much more sort of citified and straight lines and linens and clean. But really, it's got to work. James has to be comfortable in that role in those clothes. And so I think with the sunglasses, Keith got a bunch of sunglasses and we tried them on and we thought those are the ones.
Sometimes you just put something on and you go like, yes, this is it. I think costume wise, the biggest decision I think we made was to make him more friendly and softer in the beginning of the movie when they're on vacation, and then try and just gently sort of, as much as he goes to like outdoorsy woodsmen, when they come to the countryside to visit at the farm, trying to soften that change a little bit with like softer plaids and softer colors, and then get harder and harder and harder. And then you were quite keen to just literally start stripping off layers towards the end of the movie, so that it's literally just you're seeing skin and you're seeing like more animal than you are civilized person.
He's a beast at the end, isn't he? So it's like, and it is that notion of stripping back to, as we say, we talked a lot about Paddy as an animal and, and what the animal is and how that is and how he sort of stalks. And there's all the metaphors in the film about a cat playing with the food and all that sort of stuff. And so, and the movement, the sort of stalking movement that James has at the end is very animalistic.
I hate to keep going back to Split then, James, but are there characteristics that you sort of pulled from that helped Paddy? Is it good that you did this after that performance, or are they just completely disconnected?
There may be crossovers, but they're not consciously pulled from anything. You know what I mean? Most of the work I do is pretty instinctual. And then in terms of characterization, I keep a pretty strong eye intellectually on the story, and I'm quite conscious about that. But then my response to the story in terms of what my character ends up doing is usually pretty instinctual and in the moment. But physicality-wise, it's, yeah, it usually just comes quite naturally. And if it doesn't come quite naturally, I'm the wrong guy for the part, and I usually don't accept the part. Honestly, after reading it the first time, I probably had 80% of my performance in my head. And then the other 20% that took it up a notch was what we all talked about, what you and I talked about in rehearsals, and then working on it every day and calibrating and orchestrating as we went, you know? Mm.
That's very cool. Mr. McAvoy, when you're going on a press tour for a movie that you're very proud of, that's a great movie, that's easy to talk about because people are responding positively to it, and that movie is coinciding with a new X-Men movie coming out, is there a part of you thinks, son of a bitch, I'm just going to have to answer 10 million freaking X-Men questions?
Well, yeah, do you know what's really annoying, though? I'm here to talk about this movie, and you want to get some like press out there to get people to go bums on seats, and then you kind of notice like, oh, no, the first five headlines with your name attached to them is something about some other movie, something about some other movie, something about some other, and you're like, oh, God damn it. So what I think I've done this in previous junkets, and I need to start doing it for this as well, is like, do you know what? I'm not here to talk about that. They can publicize their own fucking film.
There I go. I got my quote. It's all I need. Oh,
fuck.
We
lost something, didn't matter. Marbles.
Mr. Watkins, this is for you also, from Mr. McAvoy, I suppose. I want to know about the number of takes that you allow an actor to get, and specifically because of the intensity that's required for this role. There's so many things that James is doing facially and with his eyes, with the intensity of his eyes. And I imagine you don't want to have to ask him to do it multiple times. So how often do you often put an actor through it?
I mean, listen, James may say something different. My role is, listen, kind of you keep going till you get what you need, but also at the same time, it's very much a conversation. When you're working with James or someone like that, it's a partnership, and you're kind of always going, okay, you know, and if you know it's going to be intense, you kind of have a comment, how many do you think, you know, I don't want to, you know, and James knows, he's very good at it, and you sort of say, okay, if an actor always wants another take, I always give an actor another take, because you know that they've got something and they want, so you're insane not to do that. But also, yeah, I don't shoot a ton of takes. I think I shoot a lot of, sometimes on some scenes I'll shoot a lot of coverage, so you're doing a lot of takes again. But it's just being mindful, it's about who goes first, what it is, what's the scene, and just, you know, just being sort of common sense about it. Are you going to be exhausted when you save your performance, when you bring it?
Yeah.
That sort of stuff. And it's just, right?
I didn't feel like you were exhaustive at all. It didn't feel like millions and millions of takes. What we did do, though, was like we would go through the whole scene quite a lot.
Yeah.
Because there's so much interplay between the four characters. Mm. Sometimes one person does something slightly different, even off camera, and then it has a ripple effect around the whole cast and the whole scene. And that was fun to play with.
Well, actually, a lot of people have said it's a bit like a play in some scenes, like a four-hander in that, like the intensity.
Yeah.
And James done a lot of theatre. And it's that sort of, when they're running those long scenes, they're all in the moment and they're riffing. Yeah. And they're just, and it just, it lets them, it just breathe, doesn't it?
You know what's weird is like sometimes in modern scripts or latter day scripts, you get, it's very rare to get a scene that's longer than a page or a page and a half. Mm. 2 pages feels like a long scene these days. Mm. And what was great about this movie is that there were scenes that were longer than that. And then what that ends up doing is like the time between action and cut is long enough for the actors to all fall into the scene, and then stuff to start happening that you didn't plan. That's but awesome. When the scene is so short, it's like you don't get a chance for the scene to take its own life and start to affect the actors. So it's not what you're coming in and doing. It's almost like the scene starts to happen to you, and then stuff starts to happen to you as a response to it. Mm. You know, it's really cool when it's a bit longer.
Mm. That's organically felt in this movie as well, too. You feel like you're living in the action for longer periods of time, and it makes you feel comfortable or uncomfortable.
I also just realized how much I would love to see this play out on stage. I never once thought about that, but I would buy a ticket to that.
I am not going to be in the stage version of this. I'll tell you that right.
You want to do this 8 times a week?
No, not for me. 7 times, please. 7 times. Yeah, not for me, man. Not for me. Oof. I can't imagine living with Paddy that often. No.
Yeah. So it's funny that's a good segue, because I could keep going back and telling you guys how much I love, like, horror is my favorite genre of all time. Like, so much, like, it's a comfort for me. I can put on The Shining when I'm in bed and just fall asleep to it. And people at work oftentimes, whenever I talk about movies, like, like this, they're like, what the hell is wrong with you? Like, there are people that genuinely just don't understand the appeal of the genre and why some of us love it so much. And I'd love to know from an actor in the, you know, who's been in the genre, and from a filmmaker who's been in the genre before, what do you say to people who just don't get films like this, to people who don't understand that for some of us, like, these really are like just as weird as it sounds, like, these are like a comfort movie for me.
Well, I would also say, and I love horror, and it's not an apology for it in any way, but yeah, there are people who go, I just don't watch horror. And, you know, I go, well, would you have watched a film like Misery or something like that? You know, there are some people that don't like gore, and I get that, right? If you don't like super violence and blood, that's fine, but that's not our film. You know, so the sort of psychological thriller end of horror, which I think is what this is, that crossover. And I think, you know, that you could, the wider audience, that, you know, Kubrick, whatever, you know, those sorts of, you know, movies, I think, I, you know, those that's the area of horror that I'm most interested in, you know, where it's the horror of the human psychology, I suppose. And I think that plays broader. But there's a purity about horror, you know, it's, you go to a cinema, it's like James mentioned comedy. You go to a comedy in the theater, everyone's laughing together and the laughs are amplified. If you go see a horror movie, everyone's scared together and it's amplified. It's like live music. And it's a reason to go to the cinema, I think, is my... Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to bang the drum. Well, I am.
No, you bang the drum. It's energy. You get energy from watching a movie like this. I also think as well, horror movies don't work unless they are so brilliantly and finely crafted. It's not just like stick a couple of cameras on a couple of great actors with some good dialogue and we'll just watch them do great behavior and maybe cry about it is they've got to be so meticulously orchestrated and crafted, so you're watching, I think, a successful horror movie, you're watching something that is the work of craftspeople, really dedicated, really finely tuning things. Otherwise it's just not scary, otherwise it's just not tense, otherwise it's just not horrifying, because the horror isn't always gore or violence, as you just said. It is the stuff that isn't said, and that confidence as a filmmaker to show the space. Like, you don't show much violence in this film, you don't show much sex in this film, but the threat of it is always there. And that's actually, I think that's the artistry in that is quite high, it's quite elevated compared to some of the things that people think is high end, you know.
It's like Seven, like, you never see John Doe kill anybody, but like, it's scarier than actually seeing it. It's better when you don't see that. I agree with you 100%.
Yeah, I agree.
James, I'll get you out of here on this very last one. I know it's a question everyone's going to be asking when they leave this film. Scrunch or fold?
fold with a gentle finger.
Okay, fair enough. Good.
Yeah.
Guys, thank you so much for coming on the show. We really hope that you appreciate coming by.
Thanks, guys. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
We would like to thank the Jameses for joining us here on the show. We're going to get into our Speak No Evil review at this point. We'll keep it spoiler free. This is definitely the type of film that you should experience. All of the twists and turns that come with it. but it's tough to talk about because it was it's a remake of a film that was out somewhat recently. Sure. And there's a chance that people got a chance to see that one as well, too. I actually had not seen the remake, so I did not know where this was going at all and was pleasantly surprised by where it went. I was thrown off guard by it multiple times. I think primarily because McAvoy is so great. Like, McAvoy is truly terrific in this part. It's one of those fantastic roles. So the setup is there's a family on vacation. They cross paths with another couple, another family, a couple who have a son. And that couple kind of pulls them in, they're interacting socially. They are kind of making fun of some of the other guests that they're on the vacation with. And they eventually make friends with them and pull them into their circle. And then that circle continues to grow a little bit and they end up vacationing together. But it's this weird tightrope walk that if James McAvoy doesn't sort of thread the needle, it doesn't work, which is you don't know whether he is being artificial or genuine the whole time through and whether he's a threat or if he's just this unusual type character. And I thought he did such an amazing job of sort of keeping me guessing all the way through. And so for that reason, I thought that the film worked really great because of it. I'm blanking on the name of the girl who played his wife, but she's fantastic.
Is that Mackenzie Davis?
McKenzie Davis. McAvoy's wife. That is
Mackenzie Davis is Scoot McNairy's.
It's okay. Aisling.
I haven't seen it. Sorry.
No, it's Aisling. I'll find it. It's Aisling. I forget her last name, but I'll find it.
Okay. Another terrific performance. Like the two of them together, sort of, you know, keep you on your heels, I think, throughout as you're watching this film. And so I recommend going into it knowing as little as possible. It's, you know, a film that's going to sort of reward you the less that you know. And truly, I think it's a showcase for McAvoy. But when I kind of brought up in the interviews, because Jakey, you saw this one, when I brought up how I thought it was a continuation of, or at least an inspired by his work in Split, which, you know, we kind of gave flowers to that performance. I think that performance in Split is really tremendous. And so this is not quite on that level, but close to it in the type of juggling and balancing act that McAvoy is doing.
Yeah, you know, but it's a slow burn off the top. Mm-hmm. It does take sort of a while to get started. But you're absolutely right in that, like, it kind of has to be, in the same way that you're saying, like, his performance has to be a certain type. The movie also, everything that happens in the last act of the film doesn't mean a damn thing if you're kind of hitting the ground running 60, you know, like, mm-hmm. it really kind of builds up to that point. I also had not seen the original film, but I really thought, based off the trailer, which has kind of become an internet joke,
yeah.
Because it just plays in front of every movie. I really thought, based off the trailer, that I could have mapped out where this movie was going. Mm-hmm. And I was pleasantly surprised that structurally, like, okay, yeah, maybe you can sort of figure out A to B to C, but there were quite a bit of like tangents and variations and surprises embedded in there that I really wasn't expecting. And all of the, even like Scoot's performance, like all of them have to work for any of this to sort of play out. But that being said, going back to what you're talking about, McAvoy losing his shit is a subgenre of movies, yeah, that I will always be down for. You know, whether it's this or
that's a Letterboxd list for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Even like my favorite performance of his in the X-Men movies is Days of Future Past, where like Professor X just like had gone off the rails. Sure. You know, the I don't want your future. But like I will always be down to watch, and it's just sort of a reminder of like, I don't think we appreciate him enough as an actor.
Yeah.
It feels like every time he puts out a movie, he has to he's always really great, and everyone's like, oh my God, he's so good. And then I feel like people forget, and then he's got to do that all over again. Like, I feel like he's always constantly having to remind us that he's a really great actor.
I feel like since X-Men, not that he's slowed down, because he's consistently working, mm-hmm. but he's kind of just very much like, here's a great performance. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if he's gonna, like, if he's kind of building to a lot more work where I think he might come back. Because I feel like before X-Men, people thought he was great. And then X-Men happened.
Yeah, because he'd done Atonement.
Exactly. Yeah. And then X-Men, he was great in X-Men, but he was in that sort of pop culture zeitgeisty type conversation. I feel like he's coming back around in that.
Well, his answer to our... So a little bit of behind the scenes for people. We're recording this on Wednesday, September 11th, which is right ahead of when the movie is coming out. But we recorded this like almost a month ago, ago, mm-hmm. which was like kind of in the wake of Deadpool and Wolverine coming out. And the poor guy always seems to have a new movie coming out right around the time when a Marvel movie is coming out. And his answer to... not wanting to talk about Marvel because it overshadows his new movies, I think is was very real and very genuine.
The actress's name that I want to bring up is Aisling Fransosi, and she is
okay,
fantastic. Thank you, Gabe, for the assist on that one. Yeah, one thing about McAvoy too, always a great interview.
Yeah, yeah.
Candid, you know, isn't afraid to talk about any subject. Will give you the no bullshit answer, basically, too. Just charming as hell. Got him with Fassbender. Paired a couple of times over the years due to the X-Men movies and the two of them together.
Those were always fun chemistry.
Pairings. Yeah, it's a lot of fun going into those rooms. So I recommend See No Evil. You recommend it as well, too?
I would, yes, I would.
Yeah, I definitely think you'd go check it out. I know a lot of people are celebrating that now that it's out, they don't have to see the trailer anymore.
I saw someone posted they went to a screening and they played the trailer before the screening.
That's kind of funny.
I actually had that recently. I went to, for my screening for Beetlejuice, they played like a quick 30-second trailer before the movie started, which I thought was the strangest thing.
Yeah, that's bizarre.
Well, they had to do the third. They had to give you another Beetlejuice. I guess so. It could be three times.
I always say it'd given me a good movie.
Zing.
I like the new
Let's detour onto that one. We haven't talked about that yet. Can you guys briefly just give me a quick, Kev, give me a rundown of Beetlejuice?
Yeah, I mean, so Beetlejuice in the world of Tim Burton for me is not even top five. I would put plenty of film. I would put Edward Scissorhands above Beetlejuice 1. I would put Ed Wood above Beetlejuice 1. I'd put Sweeney Todd above Beetlejuice 1. I'd put Big Fish above Beetlejuice. I'd put Batman above Beetlejuice. Batman.
Sleepy Hollow.
Sleepy Hollow above Beetlejuice.
Yeah.
I like Beetlejuice a lot. I rewatched the original before I did the interviews for it, and it's good. I enjoy it. I feel the same way about the sequel. It works. It's fun. I think the third act of the new one is incredible. I think that entire wedding scene, the forced singing, is so funny to me. I had problems. I didn't love Justin Theroux's character. I thought that was a little over the top. I thought Monica Bellucci, who I think is incredible, needed more screen time. That character kind of fell off or in the middle of the film, I felt. I love Jenna Ortega in it. I loved Winona Ryder. I love seeing Catherine O'Hara back. To me, it felt like they gave Tim Burton millions of dollars and said, be a kid. Just make whatever you want. I mean, and I don't know that became a great film, but I enjoyed myself. I think that it's a little too long in the middle. But I'm happy about its success. What did it do? $110 million domestically. And, you know, that's
I was really surprised by that, to be honest with you.
36-year gap between. I mean, similar to the...
Is that the power of Jenna Ortega? Do you think that helps? Do you think putting her in?
I think nostalgia, too. I think people are nostalgic for Beetlejuice.
I got to give Warner Brothers credit. That is some of the best branding I've ever seen for a film. Like, I was in the mall the other day, and I walked by a store called Lush. It's like a soap store. And they had an entire Beetlejuice banner up with like bombs? Soaps. Yeah, bath bombs with Bob's face. And like, I saw it everywhere. Dude, I went to Crumble Cookie the week before.
I had that cookie.
Right.
Yeah, it was great. Like
chocolate cake.
It was mostly cake. Yeah, which was disappointing because I'm not a cake fan, but it was mostly cake.
But it's
two things smashed together.
Think about how brilliant that marketing is for a second. Everybody waits every week to find out the next crumble cookie flavor, right?
The new flavors. Yeah.
And then all week long from Monday to Saturday.
How have we never talked about crumble cookie?
I know.
Crumble's phenomenal. Dude.
I really didn't know that. Like, I know what crumble cookie, I actually like crumble, but I did not know that was like a wait weekly.
Oh, it's a thing. Yeah, you look and you check and see what the four flavors are.
Every Monday.
Week. Someone who had that on their Real Blend Bingo card is finally like, yes, I get to fill in the crumble cookie conversation.
Dude, I am obsessed. I go every Monday. I get the new ones. This week I got the peanut butter. I got the Oreo. This is not an ad.
What is happening?
I'm telling you. This. Dude, every...
I honestly just thought they had the same cookies.
No. Dude, well, they always offer a chocolate chip. There's like a traditional chocolate chip.
Yeah.
But then the other ones tend to change.
Dude, there's an entire TikTok trend of ASMR of people biting into the crumble cookie of the week. Lily Reinhart from Riverdale does a crumble cookie tasting on her page. It gets millions of views.
Yeah.
It is. So my point is, though, is like I saw Beetlejuice everywhere. And like they even had Keaton do commercials as Beetlejuice for brands.
But that's no different than like the Happy Meals of our day. You know?
No. But it felt like old school marketing. It felt like the old, like, I think it's why it did well. And I think Jenna's great in it. I think the ending is hilarious. It's also very violent. Mm. I was surprised how violent the movie was.
The Jeffrey Jones stuff was a lot more brutal than I expected.
Really? But like just blood squirting and like...
It was a lot more gory.
Really gory. And it's PG-13 and the movie's being geared towards, I'm assuming, families. Yeah. But like... Yeah, I don't know. I'm just happy for its success. Yeah.
I'm curious because, Kevin, I know you get this question too. I had a lot of people asking me like, oh, is it okay to take my kids to? And I would normally say, well, would you let your kids watch the first one? But this one's
a little
more brutal than the other
brutal.
One.
Dude, I actually did like spending more time in the afterlife, and I did like the visualization of that world. And I thought that I did think Keaton was like it. Keaton's performance in Beetlejuice 2 is as if he never left the character in one. It's almost like I don't think any time has passed like that. That's how good the performance is. Like it's 36 years later, but we covered in makeup, but you can't really see a difference. Can you tell a difference, Jake, between younger Keaton and older Keaton?
I honestly didn't think I don't know why, and I haven't been able to put my finger on it. I didn't think the makeup looked as good in this one.
You know, there's a big reason why that you felt that. It's because the original was shot on film, and the new one shot digitally.
Because like he basically looks this like he looks the same. Like he's aged very well, you know. So it's like the shape of his head and everything is the same. It's not like things are wildly different in that regard. But for some reason, it did look off to me.
Think about it this way: like Joker, we're gonna transition to Joker now. Joker 1 and Joker 2 were both shot, I believe, on the Alexa 65. I don't know if someone wants to confirm that, but they're both digital. So when you jump from Joker 1 and Joker 2, you probably won't notice a huge difference in the way you view Joaquin's makeup. When you go back 36 years ago and you're shooting 35 mil and you have the grain that kind of hides a little bit of the HD quality. And then I think Burton shot this new one digitally. I need to double check. I probably should say that before I even go out down this route, but I'm pretty sure he did. That's probably what you're seeing. You're seeing a more high def vision of the makeup than you ever imagined when you were a kid. Imagine watching Beetlejuice on VHS when you were a kid. It's so grainy and like film and like you suspend that disbelief. But now things are so high quality that's why it's harder for makeup artists now, I would argue. With these higher HD cameras, they have to do a lot more work, I would argue. Like look at Penguin, for example. Look at Colin Farrell. That's a show on HBO Max that's going to be shown on these massive HD screens in people's homes. I'm assuming, I think Matt Reeves and Greg Fraser shot digitally on the first Batman. Am I wrong?
No, I'm seeing, Beetlejuice, what I'm seeing is shot on the Sony Venice 2.
Okay, so it's digital. So Beetlejuice 2 shot digitally. But so I think that's probably what you're seeing, Jake, because you're so used to the 88 one being grainy. This is not a slight towards.
No, just a fact of life. How different it looks. Yeah. A little more crisp, a little more clean.
Yeah.
Let's transition
over
to Joker.
Not to always bring up Alien Romulus because I loved it. But that's one of the great things about Alien Romulus is that it looks like it was shot in between the films that it's in. I think to your point, Kevin, when like a film goes the extra mile of trying to nail that, I think it really helps.
Because you can add grain. Like I know, like, if you look at the Terrifier films, for example, those are all shot digitally, but they're, like, kind of meant to look like 80s horror films in a way. But you can add that grain. Remember we had James Gray on our show for Armageddon Time?
Yeah.
And he was telling us about how they added grain to it, and he could not believe how good it looked. There are ways to do it. But I think that's why you're probably feeling that way, Jake.
I am actually stunned to hear that Joker 2 is shot digitally because we're going to transition over to Joker. Foliado.
Do they say it in the movie?
No.
Uh-uh.
Tom Phillips literally told us that they only named it that way to convince Joaquin to come back because he didn't want to come back to anything that just had Joker 2 on it. So
that's came up wonderful. With
this tricky title, Foliado.
Let me confirm that real quick. I'm almost certain.
What are you looking for?
Just the Joker 2 was shot digitally.
I think the first one was.
Yeah, Alexa 65.
Yeah, I was
going to
say, I think it's the same.
Yeah.
It looks like they did exactly the same.
In each of those films, it looks like something shot in New York in the 70s, though.
Because the Alexa 65, that camera is remarkable. I mean, I think it's the same camera, correct me if I'm wrong, Gabe, that they use on The Revenant. That is such a, you can get that look on that camera. And obviously you add stuff in post and you can light things a certain way. I mean, Lawrence Shear, I think who's the DP on the Joker films. I mean, that's why, you know, Greg Fraser and all these guys, they know how to light to keep that cinematic filmmaking look. That's why you need a great DP. Yeah. But the Alexa 65, like I've seen film shot on that camera that I thought were shot on film. And then they were shot digitally. It's insane.
Joker looks that way. So I got a chance to see this one prior to its Venice release. And I'll review it. I'm going to react to it. I'm not going to give you a full review. I'm going to hide any type of spoiler that comes from it. And all I can say is I've thought about it a lot since getting a chance to see it because it's a really complicated sequel in that it subverts your expectations for what a traditional sequel would be. But I'll tell you the way that I described it to Jake after I came out of the screening. I said, if the first movie drew comparisons to Taxi Driver and even King of Comedy, then this is One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Mm. And I got a chance to ask Todd Phillips if Cuckoo's Nest was an influence on him. And he said, no, he said he and his writing partner, Scott Silver, didn't think about Cuckoo's Nest at all. But I say it in this way. The movie essentially starts with Arthur Fleck, Joaquin Phoenix's character, in prison for the events of the things that happened in the first movie. And so Todd Phillips kind of said, so he came out and spoke to us before we saw our screening. And he said, one of the things I wanted to do right off the bat with this one is, you know, there was a lot of ambiguity at the end of the first Joker, where when it ends and he's sitting across from a therapist doctor, people were questioning, oh, did all of this stuff actually happen, or was it stuff that was in his head? And he goes, we wanted to make it very clear that, yes, all the events from the first movie actually happened. He did kill the guys in the subway. He does shoot Murray on live TV. And so this is a movie where he is facing the consequences of that. And I'll stop there because I don't want to go in much further in terms of the plot. But what I can say is that it is one of the most oppressive and depressing and sad films that I've seen in a really, really long time. Even more so than I expected a sequel to Joker to be. They pull no punches whatsoever as they continue to explore who this guy Arthur Fleck would be. And if you think back to his journey through the first movie, you know, he's an outcast. He's a mama's boy. He wants to be recognized as much as possible. He gets recognition by truly adopting this horrible personality. And then it's like, okay, so where does he go from here? The sequel asks, where does he go from here, essentially? And all I can say is that the answers that it comes up with are really painful. They're really painful. They hurt a lot. I'm not saying that they're not honest and that they're not authentic. And I also can tell you that Joaquin is brilliant. He's unbelievably great in the part. Like, to remind you, he won the Oscar for playing Arthur Fleck, you know, the first time through. The first movie is a Best Picture nominee. Todd Phillips got nominated for Best Director. Joaquin is incredibly great as well too. This does not feel like an Oscar play movie at all. In a way, and I said this to Jake, and then Jake, I read this in a lot of people's reactions, and so I'm really glad to see this as well too. This movie hates the first movie. This movie takes a lot of your opinions of the first movie and essentially says to you as an audience member, you're wrong to come to that conclusion, and we're going to tell you why you're wrong to come to these conclusions. It's hard for me to describe much beyond that. I will say, yeah, people know that it's a musical, or it's been sold as a musical. I don't think the musical numbers work half the time. Sometimes they're really effective. Sometimes they really add to the feeling that's happening in the movie or the moment that's being portrayed. Sometimes they just feel like an add-on. Sometimes they don't really fit what's happening. Obviously, Gaga plays Harley Quinn in it, and she's a great singer, but Harley doesn't, the movie doesn't really know what to do with Harley. And I think it's more interesting when it's focused on Joker. But yeah, I was stunned. I want to see it again. I kind of don't want to see it again. It's a tough movie to sit through. It's just think about really uncomfortable prison movies, and really uncomfortable, like, isolation, sad loner movies. And it's like that times 10, basically. So do you guys have questions about Joker 2 that I can try to answer? Or?
I feel like we're hopefully going to be seeing it within the next 10 to 14 days or so. So,
okay.
I'm gonna hold off because I, okay. I really want to, because I'm very excited by it, because I gotta be honest, everything that you're saying,
yeah,
is selling me on it, yeah. whether you're meaning it for it to or not,
yeah.
So yeah, I'm gonna hold. That's kind of everything I needed to hear.
The domestic opening weekend range for it right now is 115 million to 145 million. And I know that there's interest in it, obviously.
The first one, just for context, was like 95, I think.
It went on to make a billion, yeah. And it was the highest grossing R-rated film of all time worldwide, until about a month ago.
Yeah.
That's when Deadpool passed it. I like the synergy between Todd Phillips and him making that announcement saying, you know, good job for you guys passing us. And
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
this year's in-game and Avatar. And
Avatar. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, the R rating is tough. It's the length is good. I mean, it's I think it's like 220. So it's not really going to factor that much into it. Yeah. So I recommend Joker 2. I think everyone absolutely needs to see it. I think you should be part of the conversation. I think it's you should readjust your expectations. I don't really know what you should readjust them to. It's not the movie that you think it is. It's not the movie that I thought it was going to be. I could say that much. I went in thinking it was going to be something. It was something very, very different, but it's something I've thought about nonstop since seeing it. And I am curious to see it again, but I think it's going to be tough to sit through.
Let me ask you this, and this is such a simplistic way of looking at it. Do you think it will make your top 10 list?
No.
Interesting.
Okay. No, I don't believe so. Let's throw it to a quick break. And on the other side, we're going to recommend a couple of things that are in theaters right now or at home on the streaming services that you guys should be paying attention to. And we are back. All right. We were teasing the fact that there's a movie called Strange Darling in theaters, and Kev was raving about it so much that Jake and I both went out of our ways to go see it. And Kev, you were right. Yeah, that movie is incredible. Tell the folks about Strange Darling. Try to keep it spoiler free if you can, because I know some people haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, as you guys know, it's it plays in that sandbox of the serial killer genre, that cat and mouse genre, but it basically throws all of those things out the window in terms of how you think things are going to go in a film like that. JT Molnar, I thought did a phenomenal job directing it. I love that Giovanni Ribisi was the cinematographer, because he's obviously an actor who we've been watching for years, who's worked with so many incredible cinematographers. I always think of his work in Saving Private Ryan. I mean, think about the work that he must have gotten to view from Janusz Kaminski and, you know, working on that film. And to me, it's interesting to watch an actor become a cinematographer in a way, and kind of watch them lens a scene and light a scene, knowing that he's been on the other side of that camera for so many years. Willa Fitzgerald and Kyle Gowner are the two stars. I'm not really going to say much else about the plot. I mean, it's just a movie that really kind of it's told in a very nonlinear fashion. Mm-hmm. As Jake said, like if Tarantino made like a pulp a serial killer film or a horror film in some way, I thought that was a really good way to put it. I know there's some criticism online about. At the beginning, it says shot entirely on 35mm, why they had to put that on the screen. But I actually think that's a really cool thing to get people kind of more invested in using film. I think there's a reason.
Yeah, who would care that they put that? I think that's cool.
I guess some people, I don't know for sure, but people who are really more of the digital side of filmmaking could take it, in the wrong way. But I thought it was just remarkably well made. And you really don't know what's coming, and they do a really good job of really kind of throwing everything at you and making you think. And I remember the actors talking about the idea that they're not trying to misdirect you at all, mm-hmm. but the filmmaking and the music cues and the way that the scenes are designed are all really kind of beautifully misdirected and kind of make you think one thing. And I just found that really interesting. It was an experience that I hadn't really seen before.
The script is so incredibly smart in the way that it structures itself.
And Willa Fitzgerald's face, like the way her facial expressions operate in this film, like when she's running, there's something about, I remember interviewing her for it, and she said she wasn't even like conscious of what her facial expressions were doing. It was just, it was all coming out of what the character was giving her.
Yeah.
So these wild facial expressions and moments that you have where we're close up on her face and she's reacting a certain way, that's all being done from the emotion of what she's gathering from the character. I thought her and Kyle Gowner were amazing, but I think I would argue that Willa Fitzgerald deserves an Oscar nomination for this. And I don't know if it'll happen because it's such a smaller film. I think the studio is Magenta. I'm not familiar with, but I mean, as we're seeing this year, you know, A24, you know, they came out the gate as a smaller studio, And they have obviously proven themselves and become a much bigger deal. They're, you know, they're still not Paramount, Universal, or Warner Brothers, but when they came out the gate, they were a small studio who's now really kind of become very successful. Neon, I think, is also starting down that path as well. You know, this year with Long Legs making almost $100 million. Mm-hmm. So I love that these smaller studios are really kind of finding original material or finding films that you wouldn't maybe see at a larger studio sometimes, and giving filmmakers the opportunity to do it and then seeing how audiences react. Obviously, A24 has become a juggernaut in the industry. They're huge. But, you know, it's funny. I was watching Midsommar and Hereditary recently. And, you know, even A24 at that point wasn't what it is now. And you see that logo, that you see that studio name now, and it means something different. So go out and support this film if you get a chance. It's a really remarkable film. My favorite film of the year at the moment.
Shaggy, what'd you want to throw in?
No, I mean, everything Kevin said is spot on. I love this movie because this script knows all of us so well.
Yeah.
This movie knows what we think of every moment, yep, and what we think of every turn and what our expectations are for every plot twist. Yeah. And it's as if the script went into our brains and said, okay, well, they think we're going to turn left, so let's make sure that at this moment we turn right.
Every time.
Every time. Every
and it's time. Not done in a way where it's pretentious. Like,
No, not at all.
My biggest problem with Last Jedi, not to start that whole argument again, but
please, we can't
but
get
my
that.
Biggest problem with that film, yeah, though, was when Luke throws the saber over his shoulder.
Yeah.
That felt like, again, this is just my opinion, it felt like the filmmakers were saying, here's what you think's going to happen, we're going to flip it the other way around. No. And that felt, it felt like it was on purpose. Right. Here, it doesn't feel like that at all.
It's basically, yeah, just saying like, oh, like, so like, you thought X was going to happen. What? Like, okay, but why? Why?
Right, yeah. And then I was like, shame on me for thinking that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like, okay, well, like,
shame on me, you know, for thinking that. Now I'm an idiot.
I love this movie. I love that. And I don't think this is a spoiler, Gabe. Feel free to cut it out. But I love that the opening scene is one character chasing another. It is basically what you would think would be the finale of a slasher movie.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it's chapter 3 of 6.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you, cool, it just makes you pause and go, well, how did we get here?
Yeah.
And what do you mean this is chapter 3 of 6? How the, you're telling me this? You're telling me the moment that is normally the crescendo,
right,
of a slasher movie is the middle of this story?
Right.
Yeah. Like, how, where the hell do you go from? And even like,
so
I took it as a the opening scroll as a love letter to Texas Chainsaw.
Yes.
Oh yeah.
That was such a, with that deep voice reading over about the, yeah, killings and everything. And
I will just say that the structure is brilliant. My only issue is that, to me, then, as each of the chapters played out, I was thinking ahead of like, okay, well, then are they going to show 4 next? And then is it,
yeah,
1? And then is it going to be 6? And,
yeah,
then 2?
See, I didn't mind that.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're, okay, supposed, I think it's supposed to be playing with you. I think you're supposed to be working with it, almost working forwards and backwards at the same time.
Okay.
Like, where am I? When does this happen? When do they meet the older couple in the woods? Like there's so many like factors.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's,
yeah,
so cool.
It's great. Okay, so head to the theaters, go see Strange Darling. If you're at home, I want to recommend, because it's been really fun over the weekend to see people finding this on social media, Rebel Ridge is playing on Netflix. And we've even seen, so we had the director Jeremy Saulnier come on the film, come on the show. He was on last week. He did Blue Ruin. He did Green Room. He has this new film, Rebel Ridge, that's out. People are finding Aaron Pierre, who is a phenomenal actor, is the lead in this opposite Don Johnson. You can read on Cinema Blend and also in our interview with Jeremy, he talks about how John Boyega was originally going to be in the part, had to leave the production for personal reasons. They replaced him with Aaron Pierre, and I cannot imagine anyone but Aaron Pierre being in this movie. So if you haven't yet had a chance to go check out Rebel Ridge, that's available on YouTube right now. To me, it's a modern take on sort of First Blood. Some people are comparing it to Reacher as well, too, where it's a wanderer kind of who stumbles upon some small town corruption and does what he can to sort of clean things up. So there's your recommendations for the week. And YouTube, neither of you have seen Rebel Ridge either, have you?
Not yet.
I have not.
What is wrong with you guys?
I was going to watch it, but then I was like, nah.
Nah.
All right. Well, I'm just kidding. Really I actually good. Really do want to see it, but really that's good. It. Yeah.
Nice thank job. You. All right. Your outro for this week is a reminder. Once again, let us know the scene or the moment that first jumps into your mind when you think about the late James Earl Jones, who we lost this week, unfortunately, sad passing, an icon. Thank you very much, guys, for tuning into this week's Real Blend. We'll be back really soon with a brand new episode. Follow us on social media. In the meantime, while you're waiting for new content from us, we are at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean _ O'Connell, at Gabe Kovac, and the show is at Real Blend. Talk to you guys soon. And according to one of our listeners, I'm supposed to end all the episodes from now until the movie comes out with Night Bitch.
I'm saying Dunkirk.
Okay, fair enough.
Save big on your next project right now at Menards. Save time on your paint project with help from Duck Clean Release Painter's Tape. Use on walls, trim, glass, wood, or metal for clean removal and clean paint lines every time. Save big and get a 3-pack of Duck Clean Release Painter's Tape on sale now through September 22nd. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big.